Students, faculty, and members of the Baltimore community, I would like to welcome you all to the fifth event of the 2013 Foreign Affairs Symposium, featuring Deputy Executive Director of Advocacy, Policy, and Research at Amnesty International USA, Frank Januzzi. My name is Sarah Horton, and I am one of the four executive directors of this year's symposium. Before we begin tonight's event, we would like to remember the victims of the tragedy in the Boston Marathon. The Johns Hopkins community is keeping the victims and their family members in our thoughts. The Foreign Affairs Symposium is an entirely student-organized and student-run lecture series that invites prominent world figures to speak at Johns Hopkins during every spring semester. Through six unique events this spring, we will learn from a variety of experts that are shaping current global, domestic, and global policy. The theme we picked this year for our symposium is From the Front Line to the Bottom Line. From the Front Line to the Bottom Line is meant to reflect the insights of individuals entrenched in leadership in fields as different as business, journalism, policy, government, and the military. FAS aims to provide a forum for thoughtful, intelligent debate. We remind you to be respectful of our speakers, who have graciously taken time to come to Baltimore to speak at Johns Hopkins. Some of you may agree with the viewpoints of tonight's speakers, and others may disagree. Regardless of your position, we ask you to respect his positions and views and challenge our speaker on his remarks during our question and answer period. At this point, please be sure to turn off your cell phones. We will open the floor for a short question and answer session following the speaker's remarks. Please use the microphones in the aisles for your questions. We ask that you limit your questions to one per person. And following the question and answer, we will have a short reception outside. Frank Januzzi serves as Deputy Executive Director of Advocacy, Policy, and Research at Amnesty International USA, the head of the Washington, D.C. office. Mr. Januzzi is an international affairs, policy, and political expert who most recently served Chairman John Kerry as Policy Director for East Asian and Pacific Affairs for the Democratic staff of the Foreign Affairs of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His Senate service included work on human rights legislation, as well as field investigations into human rights and security conditions in numerous East Asian hotspots, including China, Tibet, Burma, Cambodia, South Thailand, Vietnam, and North Korea. Prior to joining staff of SFRC, Mr. Januzzi worked as the East Asia Regional Political Military Analyst for the Bureau of Intelligence and Research of the U.S. Department of State. His portfolio at INR included China's defense modernization, the Korean Peninsula, insurgencies and civil wars in Southeast Asia, and territorial disputes in South China Sea and Kuril Islands. In 1990, he worked as a refugee officer on the Thai-Cambodian border and returned as an elected officer for Cambodia's UN-run electoral officer for Cambodia's UN-run elections in May 1993. Mr. Januzzi was the founding editor-in-chief of Peacekeeping Perspectives, the State Department's classified journal on multilateral peacekeeping and humanitarian operations. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Frank Januzzi.
Moving just to make sure, make sure that works. Can you still hear me if I'm over here? Very good. All right, I see fingers and hands up. And I'm also going to find a clicker somewhere, or is that by my ACE technology supporter person? There's a mouse. All right, great. Thank you. Good evening. I'm delighted to be here. I did not have to come far. I live at 2523 Guilford Avenue. So the advantage for me is that this is my hometown. It's not where I grew up, but it's where I've been for more than 20 years. And so it's exciting for me to come back to Hopkins, especially to be in Mud Hall, where my wife spent the briefest 9 years of her PhD thesis work imaginable before getting her doctorate in genetics here from Hopkins. So for me, this is really a great chance to come home. And that is electronics. And it's on me. And now I'm liberated from the concerns of the world. I'm here tonight to talk to you about my passion, which is human rights, and especially human rights in Asia. I'm going to touch on a couple of other topics about Amnesty's work in the world, because I realize that not everyone here cares about East Asia as much as I do, or came to hear a talk devoted to some of the greatest human rights challenges that we face in the world, which is the human rights challenge posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. But I will be delighted in Q&A to address human rights concerns that you may have more broadly and globally. I wanted to start by at least letting you know. Who Amnesty is. Most of you probably have at least a passing familiarity with Amnesty International. We are the world's largest grassroots human rights organization. We were founded in 1961 to advance the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights around the world. We take no government money. We take no corporate money. We are supported by our membership. 3 million people worldwide, 250,000 people in the United States. And we are both advocates for human rights here at home, and we're advocates for human rights abroad. We work to protect people wherever justice, freedom, truth, and dignity are denied. And our symbol of the candle wrapped in barbed wire is a symbol of both the light we try to shine on injustice around the world, but also a symbol of hope that the world can move to a brighter future, one that is illuminated by respect for human rights. Now, our philosophy, that's an earlier version, but our philosophy is that human rights are not just a domestic concern, that none of us have the luxury to ignore human rights challenges around the world because we feel comfortable that human rights are being respected just where we are. Our belief is that the Vienna Declaration and the Program of Action from the 1960s reaffirms that human rights are a global concern of the international community, and that we each have a responsibility to be human rights defenders and advocates. The promotion of human rights should be a key part, we believe, of every country's foreign policy. Amnesty International, I've only been an employee of Amnesty International for 1 year. And in fact, today is my 1 year anniversary. So I could think of no better way to spend it than to bring some of the hopeful messages of the last 12 months to this audience. I left government after 23 years because it had not yet beaten every fiber of idealism out of my body. I still had a little bit of idealism left, and I wanted to try to put it to good use in the advocacy community rather than working directly for the U.S. government where I'd been for a long time. Now, I was sharing with some of the students over dinner that in Washington, you have to think about power as flowing from two sources, and it's not the two that you might suspect. I suspect many of you would say that one of those sources at least was money. But in fact, in my experience in the government, that's not true. Power in Washington flows from access and information. Access is sometimes purchased by money, sometimes. But it is the access that gives people power, not the cash itself. And information is the currency, it's the lifeblood of Washington, D.C. People with good information have influence. People with bad information lose their reputations, they don't get respect, they're not listened to, they lose influence. So access to the people who are in position to make change and information, good analysis that you can bring to them to try to change their view and mobilize them. Amnesty International is blessed to have both of these things. We have good information because we have hundreds of researchers around the world who are looking into human rights abuses around the world, shining a spotlight on them, and being willing to speak truth to power. And we have access because we have clout, and our clout derives from our membership and the fact that we can mobilize 100,000 letters to Putin in 3 days to free the band Pussy Riot if they're arrested. We can mobilize tens of thousands of people on the streets around the world to try to push governments to adopt the arms trade treaty. Or we can work in coalition with like-minded groups, as we did recently in Maryland, to try to abolish and successfully abolish the death penalty. We've had some successes in the last year. Death penalty abolition in Maryland is something that's close to me because I'm a Marylander, but also the Marriage Equality and the DREAM Act passing through the Maryland referendum process, Violence Against Women Act being passed by the US Congress. This is something, again, close to me because my old boss, Senator Biden, was the original author of that legislation. It was recently reauthorized by the US Congress with new protections for indigenous peoples, Native Americans, Alaskans, and immigrants. Global Conventional Arms Trade Treaty, I spent most of the last 4 months doing battle with the NRA, which is fun. I mean, for those of you who haven't tried it, let me tell you, it's fun. And the chances of success apparently were a little bit greater on the international market than they were on the domestic front. But we were successful a couple of weeks ago in getting the world, through the UN General Assembly, to adopt a new convention regulating the global trade in conventional arms. And it's not what I came to talk to you tonight, although I could talk to you about it. I think what you need to know and be aware of is that the world actually has more regulations governing the import and export of bananas than we have on the import and export of conventional arms. That's a true fact. And that's crazy. More than 50 countries have no licensing requirements at all for the import and export of conventional arms, and no human rights standard that's applied on whether or not a state should be a recipient of conventional arms. And what the Arms Trade Treaty is going to do for the first time, when it enters into force, after the U.S. signs it on June 3rd and 50 other countries ratify it, is going to establish a norm which says, you know what, if you have knowledge that your arms export is likely to be used to facilitate genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, then you ought not to sell that weapon. Right? So it's a very common sense, kind of a golden rule. If you know that your export is likely to be used to commit atrocities, then you ought not to export. The United States already has those rules, by the way. So it's not really going to change much about the way the United States behaves. But for the other countries in the world who need to bring their laws up into compliance with those norms, it's going to make the world a little bit safer over time. It's not a panacea. It's not going to end armed violence. It addresses a question that Susan Rice spoke to when she addressed the United Nations last year about Russian arms sales to Syria. You all are aware of the civil war ongoing in Syria. You know how bloody it is. Amnesty International has used satellite technology to document the use of heavy weapons against civilian areas indiscriminately in Syria. But Susan Rice, Ambassador Susan Rice, said last spring, she said, what the Russians are doing in Syria in selling weapons is reprehensible, but not illegal. Well, what this treaty does, it's going to make it illegal. And because there's no global police force, there's not going to be any gendarme knocking on Putin's door late at night and saying, excuse me, President Putin, you're violating the law by selling weapons to Syria. But there will be the power of civil society. There'll be the power of international condemnation. There'll be the power of the international norm that says, you know what? What you're doing is not just reprehensible. It's illegal. It's a violation of this international treaty obligation, and you ought not to do it. As for the opponents of the treaty, three nation states, North Korea, Iran, and Syria, right? Big surprise, right? Big surprise. They are not unique in violating human rights. I don't know of a country on the planet that has not violated human rights or is not currently violating human rights, including our own. But if you had to name three as consistent malefactors, they would be high on your list. Of course, they were joined by their good friends at the NRA in their opposition to the treaty. Final success that I wanted to share with you tonight before I get into my talk about North Korea is my own visit to Vietnam about a month ago. And this was the first trip by Amnesty International to Vietnam in 24 years. And again, the ability of Amnesty to be welcomed to Vietnam speaks to the clout of our movement globally, as well as the changes that I think hopefully may be underway in Vietnam. I'll be going back in the fall to follow up on that initial icebreaking visit. So our movement is hopefully accomplishing some things in the human rights field. We have not accomplished anything here yet. All right? Now, I've been 5 times to North Korea. And the first time that I visited North Korea was in 2001. And at that time, I was working for Senator Joe Biden. Most of you know him now as Vice President Biden. But for me, he was always Senator Biden. And as somebody who worked for Senator Biden, I can tell you that I have never in my life ever called him Joe, right? It was always Senator Biden or Senator. And that was after 12 years. I was with him for the last 12 years of his Senate career. I was at his home. I was at his daughter's wedding. I mean, it's Senator Biden or Senator. He's an old school kind of guy. But when I was working for Senator Biden in 2001, George Bush had just been elected president. And at that time, there was something called the agreed framework. There was this nuclear agreement that had been signed between the United States and North Korea that was designed to rein in their nuclear program. And the agreement was kind of teetering on the edge of collapse. President Clinton had welcomed a very senior North Korean marshal, Marshal Jo Myung-nok, to Washington, D.C., the highest ranking North Korean official to visit the United States ever. And then he'd sent Madeleine Albright off to Pyongyang, capital of North Korea, to meet with Kim Il-sung. And there was even talk of a presidential visit. President Clinton was going to go to Pyongyang. And then at the end, he decided not to. He said, well, no, maybe I better go to the Middle East instead. I only have a couple months left in my presidency. I'm going to try to make peace in the Middle East. That's ambitious. It would have been equally ambitious for him to have made peace in North Korea. But I wish he'd have made a different choice. But it was what it was. So George Bush gets elected. He gets elected having campaigned against the agreement that was in place. So you have to sort of put yourself in Pyongyang. It's spring of 2001. Cherry blossoms are getting ready to blossom in Pyongyang. And they have beautiful cherry trees. I mean, it's really lovely in springtime in Pyongyang. And you're saying to yourselves, China, they've gone capitalist on me. They're not really a very good, reliable, fraternal communist friend anymore. Soviet Union is gone. Japan's my sworn enemy. South Korea wants to absorb me. And the Americans, they cut a deal with me 7 years ago, but boy, they sure haven't fulfilled a lot of the promise of that deal. You know, they were going to normalize relations, establish diplomatic relations and embassies, and lift trade sanctions, and do all those things, and none of it happened, right? For a variety of reasons that are the responsibility of both countries, North Korea and the United States. So spring of 2001, they got this new young Texan. I grew up in Austin, Texas. This new young Texan showing up, George Bush, not me, showing up in the White House. And he's campaigned against the deal. So they were a little nervous. And Biden says, look, Frank, you recently worked with Richard Armitage and Joe Nye on a report that was bipartisan. I know it's hard to imagine bipartisanship in Washington, but it used to still exist. There was this thing called bipartisanship where Democrats would work with Republicans. And I had worked with one of each, Richard Armitage, who became the Deputy Secretary of State, and Joe Nye, who was a former senior Democratic Defense Department official and an author of many books about smart power and soft power. Maybe some of you have read his work. And this report was sort of a blueprint. What are we going to do about North Korea? How are we going to address the North Korean challenge? And since it was a bipartisan report, Senator Biden said to me, look, Frank, why don't you go over to North Korea, take a State Department guy with you, maybe take a military escort, sit down with the North Koreans and see what you can do to reassure them that this cowboy, Bush, is not going to shred the agreed framework. Because after all, you worked with Armitage. Now he's the Deputy Secretary of State. You can reassure them that, you know, just sit tight. It's going to be okay. So I got ready to go, and I reached out to the North Korean mission in New York. They said, sure, you know, come on. We'd be happy to have you. Bring your team. You and your State Department guy, your military escort, whatever you want. So then I got a little clever. I said, well, okay, I got to get myself a real Korea expert because I don't speak Korean. So I reached out to the State Department where I used to work. I got myself a Korea expert who was going to be sent over from the State Department. And then I got a little maybe too clever, although this didn't end up having any effect. But I said, now, who would be the ideal military escort officer to bring with me for a discussion about international security matters with the North Korean government? How about an ICBM missile base commander? So I got myself an Air Force commander who runs one of those silos that are secretly located somewhere in our country. And the three of us as a team got ready to fly off to Beijing and then to Pyongyang. And I got on my plane, I flew off to Beijing to pick up my visa to go to North Korea. And when I got to Beijing, I had some sort of disconcerting news. The Bush administration had said publicly that they were willing to engage with North Korea, but they would do so at a time and a place of their choosing. And National Security Advisor Condi Rice had decided while I was in the air off to Beijing that this was neither the time nor the place. So she said, no go on the State Department escort, no go on the military escort. And she instructed Colin Powell to call Senator Biden to turn off my trip. Well, it turns out that both Colin Powell and Senator Biden are very stubborn men. And so Colin Powell called up Senator Biden. He said, Joe, because like, apparently he can call him Joe. I can't call him Joe. He said, Joe, the White House has asked me to call you. I can't do his accent, I'm sorry. But the White House has asked me to call you and tell Frank not to go to North Korea. And Senator Biden said, well, Colin, he says, are you asking me or is the White House asking me? The White House has asked me to call you. And Senator Biden said, thank you very much. He's going. Put the phone down. So I went. And I spent 8 days in North Korea. I went to orphanages, food aid distribution sites. I met with the North Korean military to discuss the recovery operations for U.S. remains, a story that I will tell a little bit later if I have time to get to it, which I will arrange to have time. And when I came out of North Korea, it was on the eve of Kim Dae-jung's visit. The president of South Korea was getting ready to come to Washington to meet with President Bush. And all indications were that everything was teed up to make me a truth teller. Because what I told the North Koreans was, sit tight, don't panic, it's going to be okay. We're going to be able to have a relationship. If you do your part, we'll do our part. And then Kim Dae-jung came to Washington, and on the eve of his arrival, Secretary of State Colin Powell said, sit tight, it's going to be okay. Agreed framework's good to go. If you do your part, we're going to do our part. And then Kim Dae-jung sat down with President Bush, and President Bush said, time out. We got a little problem here. We're not good to go. We don't want to do our part. They're not doing their part. And the deal's really not working for us. And the whole thing began to unravel. It is a tough target, North Korea. What do we know about North Korea? We know that there is massive food insecurity and malnutrition. I've seen it with my eyes. There is arbitrary detention, torture, forced labor, and public executions on a widespread and systematic scale. There are severe restraints on freedom of movement and a near total clampdown on freedom of expression, information, and association. You cannot move from one part of North Korea to another without a permit. The 2 million residents of the capital city of Pyongyang live in splendid isolation. No one can come and visit them. They cannot travel outside without special permission. There's no freedom of movement inside North Korea. There's no freedom of information either. The 2 million residents in the capital now have cell phones, but they only work domestically, and it's only for those privileged few who have access to that level of information, and even that is a very new event. There's severe restrictions on freedom of religion. It's almost like an afterthought. As long as you're repressing every other freedom, you might as well repress freedom of religion as well. The story of religion in Korea is complicated because it was a Buddhist society with a strong Christian missionary presence. In fact, the earliest Christian missionaries were in the north, not in the south. And Kim Il-sung himself had a lot of contact with Christian North Koreans, including missionaries, and his family had Christians in it. So it's complicated, but there is not freedom of religion in North Korea. So bad are the human rights situation, is the human rights situation in North Korea, that the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, recently reported that North Korea is one of the worst but least understood and reported human rights situations in the world. And in March 2013, just of this year, the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva voted to establish a commission of inquiry. This raises at least the prospect someday of submission to the International Criminal Court cases derived out of the North Korean case study where they would attempt to indict North Korean officials for human rights abuses. This is the first time that the UN Human Rights Council has dared to do such a thing. It may coincidentally have had something to do with the fact that China was not a member of the Human Rights Council this year and was not therefore able to block it. Now, what is Amnesty doing about human rights in North Korea? We don't have a section there, and we haven't visited the country in about 30 years. I hope to go there again. When I told the North Koreans last spring, I was meeting with the North Koreans in Berlin in March of 2012, just before I joined Amnesty, and I told them very honestly, I said, well, I'm going to be joining Amnesty International. And Lee Gun, Ambassador Lee Gun, one of the senior North Korean nuclear negotiators, he did that thing that sometimes North Korean officials do. He sucked all the air out of the room through his teeth. He says, now you're going to cause trouble. So I guess he knew me pretty well. But I told them I was joining Amnesty, and I said, well, I certainly hope I'll be welcome back to your country. And they didn't say no, so I intend to follow up on it. I consider that an invitation. But the fact is that we rely on remote sensing technology. My office has four specialists down in Washington who work in partnership with photo imagery analysts. Any photo imagery analysts in the room? Johns Hopkins University is engaged in a lot of research on photo imagery. But we use photo imagery analysts in partnership with the AAAS, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, to study North Korea remotely. And what do we study? We study essentially the evidence we can find from satellites of systematic widespread human rights abuses in North Korean gulags. We know of the existence of these gulags because of defector reports and the very, very rare survivor reports written up by courageous journalists like Blaine Harden, written about by other courageous journalists like Barbara Demick, who has written the incredible books about the lives of North Koreans inside this world's repressive system. The political prison camps in North Korea are one of the very first cases to use satellite imagery to document human rights abuses and present it to the UN Human Rights Commission for referral potentially to the ICC. And I'm very proud of Amnesty's work in this area. We have studied the camps, of which there are more than a dozen. Some of them hold almost exclusively political prisoners. Others of them are a blend of traditional prison camps and political prison camps. Some of them are focused on production of goods or materials for the North Korean economy. Others are engaged in mining activities, including coal mining. And we're able to make reasonably good guesses about the population, the conditions that they live under, by using satellite analysis. All told, we believe there are more than 200,000 North Koreans living in these gulags. North Korea does not have, I heard my friend and colleague Kurt Campbell on the Diane Rehm show a couple weeks ago, he was talking about these gulags, referring to Amnesty's work. It's not true that North Korea has the highest level of incarceration, you know, in the world. That's us. That's the United States. We're number one. Yay! We're very good at incarcerating people. But the North Koreans do it without regard to the rights of the people incarcerated. They're there without due process. They're held in the most horrific of conditions. In many respects, these are death camps in that people go in and they very, very rarely come out. They are worked hard. They have inadequate access to food, medical care, heat. It's cold in North Korea. In case you hadn't seen the MASH episodes about winter, I can promise you it's cold. I've been there in January. You would not want to be in an unheated North Korean gulag without heat or adequate food in winter. We use satellite images to document the expansion of these camps, to trace new construction, to examine their facilities. This, again, analysis from 2011, conducted in partnership with AAAS. I want to thank our partners in this. We don't have the capacity in-house to do all of this work ourselves. All of these images are available on our website. I'm not going to go through them in detail with you this evening. Recently, just this year, we commissioned new imagery because we had heard stories about expansion of one of the camps. This is in the Chomabong Valley near the Kwanliso Camp 14. And the prison camp is here. And this is the boundaries of the prison camp. And it's demarcated. You can't see it on this map. But there's a guard tower with an entrance. Each one of these red squares, is it red? I'm colorblind. But each one of those squares represents a watchtower, right? But what's interesting is that the fence line is here. This is the prison camp. This area, that's a civilian area. But in the recent months, the North Koreans have established new security perimeter access control. They don't have the towers as much in the mountains. They don't need them. But when you get up there in the flatland, in the valley where the rice growing is going on, you see all the watchtowers. Those are to control access to the civilian community adjacent to this camp. And we don't know exactly why. We don't know exactly what's going on here. But we don't like it because from a human rights standpoint, it speaks to tighter controls of access of movement. And it may be that they don't want the people who know about the conditions here, you know, but who are not technically imprisoned to be sharing their stories or communicating with the outside world. We don't know. And it's something that we cannot make a firm determination about without gaining access to the ground. The change over time, the upper part of the image, you see the main entrance as it was in 2008, April, and as it is today in the bottom slide. You have a guard post, you have a security building, towers, additional controlled access and an archway, all of which is designed to regulate egress and ingress from the facility and from the village adjacent to the facility. Satellite imagery is really on the cutting edge of human rights work. It's new. And we're proud of our innovation in this area, but it is not a perfect tool. It has advantages and disadvantages. It has the advantage of gaining access to a place that we otherwise would know nothing about. We are able to capture changes over time, and we are able to conduct systematic, careful assessments and document the changes. But it doesn't tell the human story. And that's what Amnesty is really all about, is the human story, the individual cases that really tell the broader picture. We're not able to document the specific kinds of human rights abuses that we believe are ongoing in these camps, including torture. It has the most impact, therefore, when we're able to combine it with traditional methods. So if North Korea is such a difficult problem, you know, what is the road ahead on this human rights challenge? There are a lot of people out there who will tell you, we don't want to buy the same horse twice, right? Has anyone heard that expression about North Korea policy? Right, we don't want to buy the same horse twice. It sort of implies that there was once a time when we made a deal with the North Koreans to change their system and abandon all their nukes, and we paid for it, and then they reneged on the deal. Truth is, it's more complicated than that. There have been a dozen deals. None of them have been fully executed by either side or by all the parties. And I believe that one of the reasons why they have failed is because instead of focusing on the people of North Korea, they have focused on the plutonium of North Korea. And the plutonium of North Korea is something that I have a little firsthand experience with. because in 2004, I had the mental lapse to return to North Korea for a third time, having made a couple of previous visits. And this time I was invited by the North Koreans to visit their Yongbyon nuclear complex. And I was accompanied by my Republican counterpart. Bipartisanship does live. Keith Luce, Senator Lugar's man on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I was Biden's advisor on the Foreign Relations Committee. And the two of us were in the company of three other people, the most important of whom, for your knowledge tonight, is Dr. Siegfried Hecker. Has anyone heard the name before? Are there any physicists in the room? Do you know Dr. Hecker? You ever heard of him? All right. Well, you get a D. Now, Dr. Hecker was the director of Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratories. And he knows just a wee bit about plutonium, all right, as you might imagine. He's an Austrian by birth, a naturalized US citizen, ran Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratories, probably knows more about plutonium than almost any human on the planet. And we went to North Korea really for one purpose in 2004. Because a couple years before, in 2002, that deal that George Bush had campaigned against finally fell apart. It's a funny thing about deals. You know, when you campaign against them and you don't implement them, they tend not to work. So that deal finally fell apart, and the North Koreans removed themselves from the deal, and they announced to the world, guess what? We're going to start reprocessing the spent fuel from our Yongbyon nuclear reactor and turning it into plutonium. Now, we knew they had the capacity to do that, but they had pledged not to, and they hadn't for 8 years, from 1994 until 2002. But in 2002, they said, look, bet's off. Anyone remember what happened in January of 2002 that might have been a part of their thinking about this? It's just after 9/11, President George Bush Jr., or Xiaobushi, as the Chinese call him, little bush, little shrub, he had announced that North Korea was part of the Axis of Evil. Right? Chances are you don't want to be in the Axis of Evil. And if you are in the Axis of Evil, and it's 2002 springtime, and the United States is getting ready to invade Iraq, a country which doesn't yet at that time have nuclear capacity, and therefore is vulnerable to US attack, and you've been labeled as one of three in the Axis of takedown, we're coming to get you, and you're not stupid, you might decide that it would be smart to arm yourself before they get around to taking you out. That's exactly what they did. And in 2002, they rushed to reprocess 8,000 spent fuel rods from their nuclear reactor, heavy water graphite moderated heavy water reactor, a Magnox fuel for those of you who are really into the tech geek side of this. And they extracted some unknown amount of plutonium. I say unknown because we weren't there, because all the inspector has been kicked out and the deal was broken, and so there was no way for us to monitor it firsthand, which is why 2 years later, when we had an opportunity to go visit, we did. I did with Dr. Hecker. So we went inside to North Korea, and you have to ask the question, well, you know, why did they allow us in? Pretty obvious answer. They wanted to show us something, right? It's not because they had to show us something. They wanted to show us something. And they let us tour all the facilities, and they showed us the reprocessing facility, and they showed us where they had made the plutonium, and, well, not the plutonium, where they had extracted the plutonium from the spent fuel. And then they sat us down over a cup of tea, and they said, congratulations, you've now seen our nuclear deterrent. And we said, I've been talking already 45 minutes, haven't I? I need to cut soon. I said, no, you haven't. You haven't shown us the nuclear deterrent. You've shown us that you have the capacity to make plutonium theoretically. You haven't shown us anything, really. Oh, what would it take to convince you? And Dr. Hecker says, well, I'd like to see some product. Show me a little product. All right, you sit down and we're going to talk about it. So they're calling Pyongyang, and all right, an hour later they say, good news, you get to see some product. Come on down to the basement. So we go down to the basement of the nuclear power plant. It's January in North Korea. It is minus 20 inside the building. It's minus 10 outside. I mean, it's really, really cold. And we go down to the basement, and two lab-coated guys come in, like Adam Hall. They're wearing their short lab coats, and they put a steel strong box down on the table, and they open it up. And inside the steel strong box is a wooden box. And it's like one of those Russian dolls now. I'm thinking, how many layers are we going to get to? And they open up the wooden box, and inside the wooden box are two, like, mayonnaise jars. And they got some saran wrap over the top with lids, like they've canned some tomatoes. And they pick up one, and they say, uranium hexafluoride, right? That's the powder from which you later are maybe going to alloy some nuclear weapons material. And then they open up, they don't open up, they take up the other jar, and they shake it, and there's a little chunk of metal in there. And they say, that's our plutonium, plutonium alloy, alloyed with a metal, right? Stuff that goes boom. Dr. Hecker, I'm doing this. I'm like, oh, plutonium, very nice. I think I'll just move back here to the wall. Is there any, can I get farther away, please? I didn't know plutonium. I didn't know that I wasn't at any risk. And even if I wasn't at any risk, I didn't sure I was going to trust them that I wasn't at any risk. Dr. Hecker's having none of that. He's saying, well, I'd like to hold it, please. And so, you know, they start to unscrew the mayonnaise jar, and they say, no. He says, that's okay. I said, you can leave the lid on. I just want to hold the jar. And could you bring me some gloves, please? So they bring him, I'm not kidding you, like some Playtex dishwashing gloves. And he puts those on, and then now he's going to hold the plutonium. And it's minus 20 down there, and he's kind of holding it for a while. And then he starts asking technical questions. Oh, gee, it's not very warm. You know, and I don't know what he's talking about. He's talking nuclear science with the scientists. And he later explains to me that he thought that it was pretty good stuff. Which brings me full circle. They have nuclear capacity. They've demonstrated that. 2 years later, they tested a nuclear bomb. But what do we do about their human rights problem, and how do we solve the nuclear problem if we're focused on the plutonium? Everyone's been focused on the plutonium for 30 years. Nothing has worked. My immodest proposal is that we need to be focused on the people. We need to be focused on the human dimension of the North Korean problem. The reason is pretty simple. Would we care so much about North Korea if they had nuclear weapons, if they weren't also run by a 29-year-old untested leader with a system that represses their own people and starves them to death and brutalizes them and restricts their basic human rights? If they were, as a North Korean official told me once, I kid you not, we'd like to be the Israel of Northeast Asia, right? If they were, you know, a country that was not at war with their neighbors, still technically at war, if they were a country like India or Pakistan even, God forbid, not exactly the most responsible nuclear weapons state I'd like to have on the planet, our level of concern would be ratcheted down at least a few notches. We might not like it that they had nuclear weapons, but we wouldn't be in the position we're in now. And I think the way we get there is by focusing on the people. We focus on the people by opening up the country and changing the attitudes of the elites. I don't think North Korea is going to be changed by popular revolution of 18 million starving serfs, right? It's going to be changed by the sons and daughters of the elite, like it was in Burma with the sons and daughters of the generals, who fly off to Singapore and say, Papa, why is it they have electric power in Singapore and not here? Why is the shopping so much better in Bangkok than it is in Rangoon? How come I can't get an education? How come our country uniquely in Northeast Asia is impoverished and hungry when every other country is successful and vibrant and economically engaged? So we've got to change the attitudes about the elites, and the only way to do it is through engagement. And the way to do it, arguably, in engagement, is through a multilateral framework like the Helsinki process, which could, over time, again, no panacea, change attitudes among the North Korean people and the elite by exposing them to knowledge about the outside world. The North Korean people are hardworking, smart, and disciplined. They want a better future. And if we were to show them a pathway and they could come to understand that the obstacle to their accomplishing that was not in Washington, but was in their leadership in Pyongyang, then I think they might affect change. Hopefully peaceful change. Hopefully glasnost and perestroika, gaiga kaifeng, reform and opening up. But nonetheless, it offers us, the world community, a chance to engage on the North Korean human rights challenge in a way that will be hopefully more productive than the way we've been engaging up till now. Because every tool that we have brought to bear on the North Korean problem to punish them for their pursuit of nuclear weapons has ironically only deepened their isolation and made it harder for us to launch the kinds of people-to-people initiatives, humanitarian assistance, addressing the nutritional and public health needs of the Korean people, addressing their human rights needs, that I believe over time would affect change. So I thank you so much for your attention. If we can bring the lights up, I don't know if I have the power to do that here. I might actually. But I would welcome your questions, either about North Korea or about human rights and the work of Amnesty globally, or other East Asian challenges that face the United States. Again, thank you so much for your attention. If you could tell me your name, not because I'm taking notes or sending it to the NSA, but I always like to know who I'm talking to. It'd be great.
My name is RG.
Hi, RG.
I wanted to know, what is the status with aid regarding North Korea? Do we send any aid? Have we ever sent any aid? And when you see aid as like one solution that could help get the government in line?
Great questions. Currently, there's very little aid going into North Korea. Almost all of the aid that is going into North Korea is being administered by U.S. and a few international non-governmental organizations, and it's on a small scale. In the early 2000s and in the mid-1990s, there was large-scale food assistance going into North Korea. Just to give you a sense of the scale, North Korea needs about 4 million tons of food grain per year to meet their basic minimal food consumption needs. During the height of the foreign assistance, 500,000 tons of that was coming from the international community, principally the United States. That aid was administered through the World Food Program, which exhaustively monitored the distribution of that aid, although not as strictly as they wanted to be able to monitor it. But I can tell you, as somebody who visited the orphanages and the schools, as someone who has seen the nutritional studies done before and after the aid was distributed, that I believe the vast majority of U.S. food assistance administered through the World Food Program reached its intended targets. Is it an effective way to promote change in North Korea? No, it's not. The aid is distributed outside of Pyongyang to the disenfranchised peoples of North Korea who have been triaged by their government to die, right? And although they will be grateful for it because it arrives in bags with giant American flags, gift of the American people, so it's well branded, the fact is that their attitudes don't matter very much to the future of North Korea. They are under a police state. They're not able to talk, to organize, to share perceptions. And even if they did, they would probably say to themselves, partly because of the propaganda, gee, isn't it nice that our dear leader was so clever to extort this aid for us? So it's not an effective tool for social change. It is a very effective tool for stopping children from starving. And as the father of two little girls, I don't want to see North Korean children starve, and I don't believe anything about the problem that we've been talking about will be made easier to solve with starving North Korean children. So I'm a supporter of aid, but it's not the mechanism for change. And it can be administered with good monitoring. They do snap visits. They have language people who are there. They're able to track it from port to distribution center to mouth. That's not true of all the aid. Sorry to give a long answer, but South Korea for years was just dumping 100,000 tons of rice at the port and saying, "We love you. Enjoy the rice." I have no confidence that that aid reached its intended target. In fact, I believe that a lot of it may well have been diverted. But the U.S. taxpayer should feel good that our foreign assistance was carefully administered and, I believe, reached the intended targets. Yes?
Hi. My name is Lindsay. So hypothetically, the North Korean government may argue that the amnesty's use of satellite imaging is an infringement of national sovereignty. What would amnesty's response be to that?
We would say that it's not. But you raise a serious question, and I'm not an international lawyer. The question that you raise is especially valid when we think about the use of passive surveillance systems even in our own country. If a police drone circling above your house is listening in on your cell phone conversation because they suspect you might be a drug user, and they're doing it without a warrant, they're just sweeping up from the ether the signals that are emanating from your block, and they're looking to sort those signals according to certain words that might indicate that you're a drug dealer, most of us would consider that an infringement of our Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure. If they don't have reason to believe that you yourself are engaged in bad behavior, then they ought not to be doing that. We happen to have very good reason to believe that the North Koreans are imprisoning people in gulags. We've spoken to the survivors. And so Amnesty is not going to be deterred from using commercially available satellite images of the Earth to study what's going on there. We don't need their permission to do so under international law. But I'm confident that their major objections would not be so much to say, how dare you infringe on our privacy this way. I think their major objection, because I've had this conversation, would be, you're wrong, to which I always respond, great, prove it. I'm happy to come visit. And the other answer would be, these people are criminals who have been duly convicted under our laws. We don't tell you who to imprison. You don't tell us who to imprison. So they don't make the privacy argument in arguing against this kind of surveillance. They do make the argument that it's fabricated. And there I have to just rely on your trust in our brand. You know, and we care a lot about our brand. It's one of the most precious things Amnesty has. So we check and double check and triple check. You know, we don't want to put ourselves in the position that Colin Powell was in when he was holding up, you know, vials of suspected anthrax, you know, to imagine WMD in Iraq that wasn't there. We don't make allegations that we can't document.
Thank you.
Another question.
Hi, my name is Brian Hershey.
Hi, Brian.
In 2011, I traveled to Pyongyang.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you're one of the few then.
As a tourist? Yes, so with Choreo Tours.
Yeah.
And I'm.
Walter Keats, was it? The tour organizer?
It was a woman.
A woman.
Sally.
Okay. Yeah.
As I'm sure you encountered on your diplomatic trips, I mean, I'm sure you didn't encounter many candid moments, and neither did I, but the few that I did had, I did encounter a lot of humanity in North Korea.
Absolutely.
I met some interesting people in a place that I was told really had no humanity, so I just thought that was interesting to point out. My question, however, is about U.S. security policy, specifically Obama's pivot, and I was wondering if you might discuss how that affects the balance between the three nations, U.S., China, and North Korea, and if that impedes the work you're trying to do because it's such an aggressive policy.
It's a really good question. I want to echo to embrace a phrase of the right, since I've been ragging a little bit on the right. Let me give you a ditto. Isn't that what Rush used to say? About your plea to us to remember the humanity of the North Korean people. Candid moments are few and far between for foreign visitors in North Korea. You're exactly right. I had one that was, I've had a few over five visits that have been extremely memorable. One of the earliest was buying a chocolate bar from a woman who was selling it on the street. And because I don't speak Korean, but you don't need a lot of language to purchase a chocolate bar. And you can do all kinds of things with fingers and counting in Asia. And it turns out she spoke a little bit of Mandarin, and I spoke some Mandarin, so we were able to use some Chinese. But what was fascinating about the whole encounter was just that, here she was on the street selling candy bars for profit in the state-run communist society with no free market. Second, that she was on the streets of Pyongyang, but she knew the value of the yen, the renminbi, the yuan, the North Korean won, the South Korean won, and the euro. And she knew them current. In other words, she knew the current exchange rates. How the heck does she get that information, right? And so I started bargaining with her because I'm wanting to know. I don't care about the candy bar. I want to know what she knows. So I'm saying, well, all right, so you're going to sell me one candy bar for a dollar. How many do I get for a euro? I want her to know. Does a euro, is that worth more than a dollar or less than a dollar, right? Anyway, we had a great conversation about chocolate, and then after a little while, we began to attract a crowd, and I decided it was better to move on. Another really personal encounter I had was in an orphanage where I was interacting with North Korean children. And you know, these were, turns out they were 8 and 9 years old. They looked like they were 4 and 5. But children are children. And so it's really hard for them not to be candid, even with a foreigner, strange foreigner who's visiting, you know, their orphanage. And so that was really poignant. Have I filibustered your question successfully? What was your question?
My question was about the pivot.
The pivot. Yeah. All right, so everyone know what the pivot is? All right, so the premise of the question is the pivot's a fairly aggressive policy that is going to kind of reinforce U.S. power and influence in East Asia because it's such an important part of the world. Fair disclaimer, I worked on the Obama 2008 campaign. And I wasn't the architect of the pivot, but I embraced many of the basic principles of re-emphasizing U.S. engagement with the Asia-Pacific region because I think that's where our future is. That's why I became a China hand, was because I really think that Asia is where it's at. I think the pivot is a terrible name, and I think the pivot as implemented is an inadequate policy. It's a terrible name because the only image that comes to my mind when I think of the pivot is the guns of the Missouri battleship pivoting from port to starboard. So it's a very military term, a pivot. Unless it's basketball, maybe we can use the pivot. You know, send Kevin McHale over there instead of Dennis Rodman and, you know, get something going in the low post. I don't know. But we need to change our analogy if we're going to get traction with the North Koreans and the Chinese. The Chinese hate the term pivot. They see it as the battleship guns. It has made them extremely nervous and worried about our intentions, and a lot of our muscular diplomacy vis-a-vis the North Koreans has got the Chinese very nervous as well. Some people say that's good. Get the Chinese nervous. They will pay more attention to their unruly little neighbor, and they will crack down on them and bring about change. I think that overestimates both China's influence over North Korea as well as their willingness to use their influence. And does it complicate what I'm trying to do? Yes, it does. Military tension is the enemy of peace by definition. It's also the enemy of engagement. Isolation is the enemy of engagement and openness. The sanctions and isolation and punishment is not making the situation in North Korea better. It doesn't mean we can turn a blind eye on their provocations or disarm unilaterally, right? I'm a realist. I have 23 years in government, State Department, Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm not naive about the military challenges we face on the Korean Peninsula, but our policy is not working. And one of the reasons it's not working is that we don't have the right objective. You know, Condi Rice testified once before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and she was asked a very simple question: is our North Korea policy working? And she answered Senator Biden, "Yes, Senator, North Korea is more isolated than ever." And I wrote Senator Biden a note at that moment. I have enormous respect for Condi Rice, Secretary Rice, but I wrote a note. I thought she was dead wrong. I wrote him a note. I said, "Funny, I didn't know our policy objective was to isolate North Korea. I thought our objective was to get them to get rid of their nuclear weapons and make peace." And of course, you can argue that the isolation was a way station along the road toward disarmament and peace. And there are times when diplomatic isolation and bringing pressure to bear are necessary in foreign affairs. But eventually, you've got to talk if you're going to use that leverage that you've created. And my major fault with the pivot is that it is too military and not enough civilian. Like, the military pieces of it I'm fine with, but where's the
Where's the funding for education? Where's the funding for development? Where's the funding for the Lower Mekong Initiative? Where's the funding for climate change work or opening up markets? It seems like a few Marines in Australia and literal combat ships in Shanghai, excuse me, in Singapore, not enough.
I agree.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is My name's Alex. So my question isn't about Korea, but it's about something I believe Amnesty International's pretty interested in, and that's mercenaries, actually. I find it a bit odd that the United Nations currently has very elaborate rules for what a mercenary is, and it bans mercenary activity. And I find it odd because the way I've been thinking about it, mercenaries don't start wars, mercenaries fight them. And oftentimes, if you go to the, what I want to say, good mercenaries, mercenaries will fight with a degree of professionalism that some armies can only, you know, aspire to. Mercenaries have been used throughout history for also causes that most people would say are good, like putting down a, you know, brutal communist insurgency in Angola in the 60s. You could also argue that, like, foreign intervention in the Spanish Civil War was mercenary activity. So I'm wondering, what is Amnesty International's position on the United Nations ban on mercenary activity, and why?
Senator Biden taught me a very important lesson when he interviewed me for my job. And he said, Frank, do you know what the three most important words are that you will ever speak to me? I said, I don't know. He said, exactly. Don't bullshit me. He might have used an even harsher term. I don't know. I don't know Amnesty's position on mercenaries. I will tell you what Senator Biden told me after he admonished me to always tell him when I don't know something. He says, well, what are the next four most important words that you can say to me? It's like, I will find out. So I will try to find out for you. And if you send me a note after the talk, I'll try to find out.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Casey. My question is about Dennis Rodman. I'm just wondering, your policy or your suggestion about, like, changing North Korea is based on social norms, and I'm wondering if the relationship that's developed between the new leader and Dennis Rodman is any, and his love of American basketball is any indication that it might actually work.
You know, I admire your question for its lack of prejudgment about the answer. You asked a genuine question, which is so rare. I wish more senators, when they hold hearings, would actually ask a question that they don't already know the answer to, and they're just asking the question to make a point. I will tell you that in a situation where we had met Kim Jong-un, where he had attended international conferences, where he'd come to the UN to attend the opening of the General Assembly and such, I would look at Dennis Rodman's ambassadorship with a great deal of skepticism. And I would say, oh gosh, you know, this can only cause trouble. Send some celebrity over there to be manipulated by their propaganda machine, to be fed a bunch of lies, to be used by them in ways that they find convenient. But in a situation where we have no contact, where we have no high-level access, where no American official has been in the same room with Kim Jong-un, I find it stunning that, as far as I know, I don't know this, but as far as I know, no one from the U.S. government has sat down with Dennis Rodman one-on-one to hear what the man has to say about Kim Jong-un. When I was working at the State Department in the mid-1990s, they hired a Hollywood screenwriter, psychiatrist by the name of Steve Pachinik. Smart guy. He did, like, hey, Senator Sarbanes is here. This man and I traveled to China together, and I will never forget what a good time we had. It was a good visit. It was hard work. We had no play time. We were making good use of the taxpayer dollars at every moment. And the key to keeping Senator Sarbanes happy, I learned, and I can reveal this secret now, but the senator needs to have a glass of ice. As long as he's got a glass of ice, I mean, the plane could be on fire, or the meeting could be 4 hours delayed, but if he's got a little bit of ice and maybe some water, he's good to go, and, you know, great forbearance with my inadequate trip planning as tour guide. But welcome, I'm so glad to see you. So Dennis Rodman has seen this guy. He's been there with Kim Jong-un. We should be debriefing him. Steve Pachinik, the Hollywood psychiatrist, was brought into the State Department in the mid-1990s to do what? To study video clips of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il in order to inform American policymakers about their personalities, right? Now, he's a smart psychiatrist, and you can learn things by studying people's video clips, but, gosh, you know, wouldn't face-to-face give you a little bit richer impression? So at this stage of the game, when we have so little contact with North Korea, I would say the more the better. And if he wants to host the Harlem Globetrotters every Friday night for a charity game in Pyongyang, I would say send them on our dime. Because it can only be good in terms of helping to reduce tension levels, open channels of communication, and begin to give us access to the country and begin to learn things. I've learned more on my 5 trips to North Korea than I've learned in 25 years of reading intelligence reports and satellite images and diplomatic cables about the country, right? Because you're there, you are absorbing things every moment of the day. And can sports diplomacy work? I mean, we had ping pong diplomacy. People made fun of it, but it was kind of an icebreaker. North Korea's been wanting to send their taekwondo team to the United States for a long time. We won't give them visas. I mean, are they a threat to us? I mean, I guess they might kick our butts. but would that be so humiliating? I mean, we can probably let them win one match, right?
Hi, my name is Rosie. First of all, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming. I really enjoyed your speech, and it's
thank
really
you.
An honor to have you here. My question concerns something that you mentioned, which is regarding the United States and human rights abuses. An op-ed was released early last week, I believe, in the New York Times about Guantanamo Bay detention camp and hunger strikes there. I was just wondering, what is, particularly considering Obama's failure to close the camp, what is your personal opinion, not necessarily the opinion of Amnesty International, on this detention camp and how we should move forward?
Well, I've learned that as an official of Amnesty International, I'm not entitled to a personal opinion. But I'll give you my Amnesty opinion, which happens to be the same as my personal opinion, which is that Guantanamo Bay is a black mark on America, that it should be closed, that the prisoners who are detained there should be tried or released, that we are caught in a new normal of war without end. And we need to escape that new normal. And the way to do it is to rededicate ourselves to the principles of justice that we have enshrined in our core documents and which we have obligated ourselves to abide by, not just in our Constitution, but in international treaties. And the President and the Congress need to find a solution. The Congress has made it difficult. Almost impossible. They've made it very difficult because they've basically said, we don't want these people coming into our federal court system. And then they've got military tribunals that aren't offering real justice. And in the meantime, you have dozens of people who have been cleared of any wrongdoing by U.S. intelligence and military officials who continue to languish 11 years after their incarceration. I'm trying to move away from use of the word detention. Detention to me sounds like what happens after school. You know. These Guantanamo Bay prisoners are not detained, they are imprisoned, right? You don't detain someone for 11 years. It sounds like they're under house arrest or something. They've been imprisoned 11 years without charge or due process. That's not right. And it ought to end. I had a discussion with Harold Koh about it. Some of you may know Harold Koh. He's a brilliant lawyer, a dean of Yale Law School. He wants to end this more than anybody because he sees it as sort of a black mark on his legacy, on his watch as legal advisor to the State Department. And he's thrown up his hands. He's dismayed about it because he doesn't see what the solution is. President needs to lead. He needs to make good on his promise. He needs to strong-arm the Congress to give him the authority he needs to bring these people to justice. If he can't do it, he should be done with it and release them. We should take that risk rather than to continue to imprison people wrongly without charge, in my view.
I am Alima Bey. You kind of answered my first question, but the question that I had was, what is Amnesty International's current workings on the rights of indigenous people to this land, yeah. United States?
We work principally on indigenous people's rights in the United States where it intersects with other rights. So, for instance, in the Violence Against Women Act, there were provisions that were enacted into law this year that extend the special federal protections and authorities and funding to address domestic violence for women into Native American indigenous communities. And we're glad to see that expansion of programs designed to protect the human rights of indigenous peoples, especially women's rights. We don't currently have much in the way of other programmatic work underway, although I had a fascinating case last year where I was working with the Sioux Nation to help their rugby team travel internationally on their Sioux passports. This is a question of pride and dignity for the Sioux Nation, which has a treaty relationship with our nation, and they felt it was unjust that they were compelled to travel on a U.S. passport, a nation which is not, in their minds, their own, even though they understand that they're born here and are entitled to citizenship rights. But this became a very interesting case for me personally, just because I hadn't dealt with such issues in the past. But we don't have a lot going on. And if you would like to see us delve more deeply into those issues, you should start an Amnesty chapter and start to lobby me for resources and attention to that issue, because we are member-led and member-driven as an organization. And if you show me about the issues and how we can make a difference, like any smart administrator, I will rush to your side and take credit for all of your accomplishments.
I have one more question.
Yes.
When Amnesty International goes into another country, what, grounds of jurisdiction do they go in under?
It's a great question. And it's important to who we are as an organization, because unlike some human rights organizations, we don't go into countries, I have to be careful here, 99 times out of 100, we don't go in uninvited. Okay. The only exception to this would be an active war zone. We have sent our researchers into Syria without permission, incognito, in disguise, to collect human rights information about the activities of both the government and the anti-government forces in order to tell the truth about the human rights abuses that are being perpetrated there by both government forces and by those who are opposed to the president of Syria. But our general mode of operation is to approach the government and request permission to make a fact-finding visit to examine the human rights conditions of that country. And then we share what we find directly with that country. And this is what I'm trying to do now with Vietnam. It's why I went there for the first time that Amnesty had been there in 24 years last month, is that I'm trying to secure the kind of relationship with the Vietnamese government that will allow Amnesty to return to Vietnam to do original field research on the human rights challenges of that country. Because we think it's very important. You know, we're not engaged in espionage, right? We're engaged in human rights reporting and advocacy. And we don't like to sneak around. There are other human rights organizations, reputable organizations, that operate differently. We choose not to. You know, that's not the way we operate. We deal directly with the government in terms of securing permission. We have certain ground rules that we demand. You know, we don't like to be brought in and then escorted everywhere. right? If you're going to let us in, you're going to let us in. And we're going to get to go where we go and talk to who we want to talk to. So when we do field research in Burma, Cambodia, and Southeast Asia, that's the way we operate. We do not currently operate in China for that reason. They won't welcome us. Although we do have a dialogue with China. You know, like we will engage them on human rights issues, talk to them, lobby them, advocate. But we don't get to do field research in China because they won't let us.
Okay.
That's another thing I'm working to change.
Okay, two questions are quick.
Okay.
So,
you,
is it one? Okay, one? Okay, can you do one question?
One last one.
All right. Is there a model that was successful in another country, or could there be a model that would be successful that would help to engage North Korea or help you be successful with?
That's a great question. Everyone hear the question, is there a model that we can point to that would help us deal with North Korea as a, how do we engage them to try to affect change there? The one model I pointed to tonight, sort of the Helsinki model, is one potential model. It's a multilateral model that showed great promise and success in the 70s and 80s in helping to end the Cold War. It's not a perfect fit for North Korea. You'd need to create something. It's not a cookie cutter transfer of the Helsinki model into the North Korean environment. But I think a regional peace and security mechanism for Northeast Asia is a model that can work. I think that people point to the Burma model. It's a flawed model because Burma had a strong, domestic, visible, vibrant civil society, democratic opposition with whom we could make solidarity. And North Korea doesn't have that. You know, a better model might be Mongolia. You know, Mongolia has come out from the Soviet Union. The Communist Party of Mongolia still exists. It's renamed and rebranded itself. They still have a lot of power. They weren't all arrested as a consequence of democratic progress in Mongolia. I think the biggest thing that's an obstacle to change in North Korea is the fear that the North Korean elite have that the substitute for the current system is their death. And so they need to be shown a model that says, you know what, if you relax your grip on power, if you open up, if you adopt economic reforms and changes, it doesn't have to mean your death and demise.
Okay.